Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Phil Dierking and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, Cambodia's national basketball team is preparing to play in the Southeast Asian Games in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, in August. Pek Mit is the team's captain. He told VOA Khmer that the team will play with a lot of heart. The Southeast Asian Games are held every 2 years in one of 11 Southeast Asian countries. The SEA Games permit teams to have foreign-born or foreign-raised players compete in events, just like the Olympics. But the athletes must play for a parent's native country. Many people believe that the Cambodian basketball team would be improved by having taller, foreign players. The team hopes to win a medal in the games. In a perfect world, the Cambodians imagine that their first medal would be a gold one. But that would mean defeating the team from the Philippines. The Philippine basketball team has won the gold medal since the SEA Games began in 1977, except for 1989, when Malaysia took first place. So Cambodia recruited 10 basketball players, 9 from the U.S. and 1 from Canada. They range in height from 1.65 meters to 1.93 meters. Rayvon Fouché is an associate professor and director of American Studies at Purdue University. He told VOA Khmer that the history of American sports showed that winning teams are driven by individual effort and desire. "And I think heart matters a lot," he said. Fouché's research showed that teams with mediocre players and a higher purpose often defeat teams that only have talented players. He said, "That's why culture and community and identity within context of sports is really important." He added, "And that's why people love the SEA Games and Olympics, because playing and competing for your nation with people who have the same identity and culture, that makes you play in a way that you probably wouldn't play before." In 2007, Sopian Duan was the first Cambodian-American player on the Cambodian national team. He says players want to compete because of national pride. "I feel like it's our job to represent our ways in basketball to fulfill that pride that everyone should have being Cambodian," he said. Austin Koldoye is the team's head coach. He said that countries regularly seek the best athletes without considering their nationalities. He added that the players he recruited are not foreigners, they are Khmer. Khmer are the majority population in Cambodia. Koldoye said their involvement helps Cambodia, which is now getting recognition around the world. Fouché says players coming from the U.S. have clear advantages. They are taller and better trained. He said those issues could lead to low morale in a team with native and foreign-born players. Sok Dur is a Cambodian native who retired after the 2015 SEA Games. He now coaches for the Cambodian Basketball League Under 17 team. He says there was no resentment toward the foreign-born players. The Cambodian players here are limited in their skills, he said. When we compete to represent Cambodia, we want Cambodians from the U.S. because of their expertise in the game. We want experience and we need their help. Koldoye says that the Cambodian Americans are role models for local Cambodians. They leave their jobs and family to come and play, he said. That is Khmer spirit.
Drought and conflict have caused a new displacement crisis in the southern part of Somalia. Gerard Waite is chief of mission for the International Organization for Migration Somalia. He said about 800,000 people fled their homes over the past 7 months. This is in addition to the 1.1 million people already displaced in the country. We have a displacement crisis on top of a drought crisis, Waite said. He also said that the newly displaced people have put heavy pressure on existing camps. These camps are, by and large, not very well managed. They are normally on private land in very cramped conditions. They do not have the basic services in these camps, Waite said. The displaced people are not living in healthy conditions and are forced to drink unclean water. This has caused over 71,000 cases of cholera or severe diarrhea in 2017, resulting in nearly 1,100 deaths. Water shortages have meant that people are drinking higher-risk water, taking water which they know to be contaminated, but they drink it anyway, Waite said. Climate experts say the recent rainy season was well below average this year. It usually lasts from April to June. The next rainy season is not expected until October, but experts warn there will be heavy crop losses. In addition, climate estimates suggest that there is a 45% chance of an El Niño weather event late in 2017. That could cause a further reduction in rain. An El Niño is an irregular weather event usually resulting in warmer than average temperatures in some places around the world. Waite said about 6.7 million people in Somalia are either suffering or near suffering from a food crisis. According to Waite, the International Organization for Migration has learned from Somalia's drought in 2011. In that period of extremely dry weather, 200,000 people are believed to have died. The need to deliver health systems to these places is extremely pressing, Waite said. However, he said they are also trying to work with the Somali government to create spaces that are better controlled and managed. Somali's finance minister, Abdurrahman Duale Bele, told VOA in May that the droughts in Somalia are cyclical. He also said Somalia has become too dependent on external aid. We have to change that kind of attitude, Bele said. There are projects meant to prepare Somalia for droughts, however. The IOM, for example, is introducing drought-resistant potatoes. The UN Development Program is helping with several projects, including creating below-surface water tanks, wells, and community water storage ponds in Somaliland. Bele said now is the time for Somalis themselves to take responsibility for solving the problem. We have the technology, the intelligence, and the know-how to break the link between drought and famine, he said. I'm Phil Dierking.
Holding hands, people jumped in the water and floated around in Boston's Charles River recently. That is something that would not have been possible years ago because the river was so polluted. In the 1960s, the music group, the Standells, even sang about the river in their popular song, Dirty Water. The swimmers were getting their once-a-year chance to cool off from the summer heat in the Charles River. It is called City Splash. For a few days each year, the state of Massachusetts allows public swimming on Boston's part of the nearly 130-kilometer river. The event is in its fifth year. It is a chance for the nonprofit Charles River Conservancy to show its efforts to build a swim park. Their idea is to build floating docks where swimmers can jump safely into the river without touching the hazardous bottom. These docks would be in areas where the water quality would be tested repeatedly. Nearly 300 people signed up to swim.
It felt refreshing and wonderful, said Newton, Massachusetts resident Ira Hart as he got out of the river. They used to talk about how it was toxic sludge, and you'd glow if you came out of the Charles. Well, I'm not glowing, at least not yet. Boston is one of the cities hoping to follow the model of Copenhagen, Denmark. That city opened the first of its three floating harbor baths in the early 2000s. On sunny days, people swim in the harbor baths surrounded by tall buildings and cars on the highways. At night, the area is filled with people enjoying music and food. Just recently, Paris opened public swimming in a once polluted canal. New York, London, Berlin, and other cities are planning similar features for their waterways. In Boston, the Charles River Conservancy still needs to raise several million dollars. It also needs to get approvals from city, state, and federal agencies. The group's spokeswoman, S.J. Port, said the biggest problem has already been taken care of. The Charles is now one of the cleanest city rivers in America. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced this month that the river earned a B grade for water quality last year, an A being the best grade. It means the Charles River met the requirement for swimming 55% of the time.
Here are examples of other cities working to allow swimming again. In Portland, Oregon, the city and a local group invited residents to swim in the Willamette River this summer. They open the first official public beach with lifeguards on the river earlier this month. They have also launched a public information campaign and scheduled events around the water. Among them was the Big Float River Parade on July 15th. People floated on the river in inner tubes and small boats. About 2,500 people participated in the party.
In London, a group of architects, designers, and engineers have plans for a series of pools in the middle of the River Thames. It would be in an area where river water would be filtered or cleaned continuously. Chris Romer Lee, a lead organizer of the Thames Baths project, said the group aims to submit plans to local authorities by early 2018. The group launched an online funding campaign last year that raised about $180,000 to work on their design. Now they are working to raise almost $20 million for the project itself.
In New York, four local artists and architects launched the idea for Plus Pool, a floating pool in the shape of a plus sign, in 2010. The water would also be cleaned or filtered. Since then, they say they have successfully tested a filtration system that removes bacteria without using chemicals. The group's deputy director said they have raised nearly $2 million to keep developing the project. They are exploring possible places on the East and Hudson Rivers and are preparing to get city approvals.
In Melbourne, Australia, the Yarra Swim Company presented its idea for a floating pool on the city's Yarra River at a show last year. Michael O'Neill is behind the effort. He said the company will reach out to community groups and government agencies in August. They want to know what people think the Yarra Pools project should offer. They also want to support other ideas for use of the river.
In Berlin, the Flussbad project calls for cleaning up a canal off the German capital's Spree River for public bathing. Barbara Schindler is a spokeswoman for the effort. She said the idea has been around since the 1990s, but has made progress in recent years. She said the organization completed a water quality study in 2015. It has received $4.6 million in government funding to hopefully create the project. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Grover Cleveland. When Americans remember him, it is mostly because he makes writing presidential timelines difficult. Cleveland was the nation's 22nd president, and also its 24th. He remains the only U.S. president to date whose second term did not immediately follow the first. Cleveland is also notable because of his personal life and because he held office during one of the country's worst economic crises. Stephen Grover Cleveland was born in the northeastern state of New Jersey and grew up mostly in New York. He was a middle child in a family of 9 children. His father was a minister, and the family did not have much money. As a result, Cleveland had little formal education. He was one of the few presidents who did not go to college. But he was able to become a lawyer. He earned enough money and developed a good professional image. In time, he became a sheriff, a mayor, and the governor of the state of New York. In his early life, Cleveland did not marry and have children. Instead, he had many friends with whom he enjoyed hunting, fishing, and eating and drinking in restaurants. But Cleveland did have a relationship with a widow named Maria Halpin. She became pregnant and said Cleveland was the baby's father. Cleveland said he was not sure if he was. However, he gave the child some financial support, the name of one of his closest friends, and his own family name. The child was called Oscar Folsom Cleveland. Shortly after the boy was born, his mother was sent to an institution for the mentally unstable. Doctors quickly confirmed that her mental health was fine, but her son was taken from her and raised by another family. The story about Halpin and the child became an issue in the election of 1884. The Democratic Party had nominated Cleveland as their candidate for president. In general, voters liked his message of limiting federal spending, reducing the power of wealthy interests, and stopping political corruption. Some called him Grover the Good. But Cleveland's opponents said his history with Maria Halpin showed that he was an immoral man. At anti-Cleveland rallies, Republicans chanted, "Ma, Ma, where's my Pa?" Pa is another word for father. But Cleveland did not comment much on the matter. His defenders said Cleveland's honesty as a public official was more important than his bad judgment as a private citizen. Voters seemed to agree. Cleveland narrowly won the election. His supporters answered the Republicans' chants of "Where's my Pa?" by saying, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Grover Cleveland's presidency was unusual because he did not want to use the office to propose laws. Instead, he mostly aimed to keep the federal government operating efficiently. He also wanted to limit lawmakers' power to help special interest groups. As a result, Cleveland vetoed many bills in his first term. He set a record at that time for saying no to proposals from Congress. One of the few ideas that he supported was reducing tariffs. Many of his fellow Democrats liked that idea too, but a number of Republicans did not. In the next election, their candidate, Benjamin Harrison, defeated Cleveland. Cleveland returned to being a lawyer in New York. In 1892, Cleveland was chosen to run against Benjamin Harrison again. The tariff issue returned. The Republicans' protective tariffs had hurt some industries, and voters answered this time by voting Harrison out of office. Cleveland returned to the White House, but this time he was not alone. Two years into his first term as president, Cleveland married the daughter of his close friend, Oscar Folsom. The bride's name was Frances Folsom. She was 21 years old at the time. The president was 49. Cleveland was not the first president to get married while in office, but he was the first one to be married in the White House. The event captivated the public. What's more, Americans adored the new First Lady. She was known for being social, charming, and beautiful. Historians conclude that she was the most popular First Lady since Dolly Madison. She remains the youngest. When the Clevelands returned to the White House, the country was entering a severe economic recession. Some of the country's biggest businesses were failing, including a railroad and many banks. As a result, investors withdrew their money from the stock market. The withdrawal caused many other businesses to fail. The series of events is known as the Panic of 1893. Soon, more and more Americans were out of work. Many could not afford houses or food. Some begged President Cleveland to intervene, but he declined. He did not think it was the role of the federal government to create jobs in order to reverse the Depression. However, Cleveland did use the power of the federal government to intervene during a famous labor strike. In that event, workers in Chicago who helped keep the trains operating walked out of their jobs. They were protesting a major decrease in their pay that did not include a decrease in their living expenses. Since the owner of the company also controlled the price of housing and food, workers appealed to him to treat them more fairly. But the company owner refused even to meet with the workers. Soon, the workers' boycott grew. Workers at other rail yards stopped working. Farmers could not get their goods to market, and others could not get the supplies they needed. Even the mail stopped being delivered. So Cleveland sent federal troops to break the strike. In the short term, Cleveland's actions worked. The trains moved again, and both the courts and most of the public agreed with the president's decision. But in the long term, Cleveland's handling of the panic, depression, and workers' strike lost the support of many voters. At the next opportunity, they voted him out of the White House again. Cleveland returned to New York and later settled in a large house in Princeton, New Jersey. There, he wrote, made speeches, sat on corporate boards, became a trustee of Princeton University, and enjoyed the respect of the people who lived in the town. He died at age 71 of problems with his stomach, heart, and kidneys. Several people said his final words were, "I have tried so hard to do right." Then and now, many people agreed with that idea. Cleveland was generally an honest man who worked hard and tried to act independently as president. But he is not considered one of America's best leaders. He did not have a clear idea about how to guide the country. Yet the opposing party, at least, may have considered Cleveland's presidency a success. After Cleveland's final election defeat, 6 of the next 7 presidents were Republicans. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.